Okay, is that better? Sorry. We're probably gonna end up going through the talk about the linguistic profile of the area and begin talking about the sect. And then we'll probably take another break, and then we'll finish off with I'll finish off the sect, and then we'll talk about the Galilee, and then maybe that'll bring us through till about six-ish, I think. I think that should be good. Just a couple of things that come up with the questions for the break, which are kind of related, which I do want to mention before we talk about language profile. One of them is this: the notion is very important to realize that there's an idea that to be Jewish in Judaism is about a bloodline. It's about a pure bloodline that you have to maintain. And this is an idea which is historically, it's not necessarily consistent. And if you look carefully, you go through the Old Testament period, you'll find that there are a number of Israelites who are clearly not Jewish. We have somebody called Uriah the Hittite. He's not Jewish, but he has aligned himself with the God of Israel, and he's continuing. We have, you know, obviously the family of Ruth who are coming in. There are many people from all nations, and the national identity, I think, was more connected with, at that time, with what God you serve and how you serve them, and how you relate to him, more so than the idea of bloodline. Bloodline, it does gain more importance, certainly some of the Second Temple period, when there were more records being kept. So we had to have the returning exiles, which is why we see in the Book of Chronicles, there's this whole, the first nine chapters of Chronicles, First Chronicles are all genealogies. And it's important because they're trying to reestablish a degree of connectivity going back to David and to the original Davidic company. But as time goes on, we find that it's more important to be part of Israel. You serve the same God, but nations are consistently coming in. So if somebody, if a Jewish person says to you that they are Jewish, and they would never ever know that. 10, 15, 16, 17 generations back, they would never ever know that because of all of the, a lot of the mixing, a lot of the proselytes coming in and everything else. So keep that in mind as we go through this. Now, a few slides on the language profile of Israel during Jesus' lifetime. What did it look like from a language perspective when Jesus was alive and the New Testament writers were all alive and the disciples? That's what we're going to talk about. The main languages involved, Aramaic, was an important language. Now, you're going to have to take my word for it when I say this is Aramaic. Yes, I think it's Aramaic, isn't it? You take my word for it for now. So we've got the language of Aramaic. Aramaic was ubiquitous. It was everywhere. It was a language that was spoken. When Israel were taken away into captivity, they were brought over to Babylon, and it's at that particular time that we find the language changes from Hebrew to Aramaic. Now, Hebrew never died. I'll come back to the moment. But there is more Aramaic comes into the language. And what we noticed in biblical literature is that the biblical text that we have from before the exile, less Aramaic is used. But once we cross over into the exile, once we come into the book of Daniel, half of Daniel is written in Aramaic. I don't know if you knew that. The first six chapters are Aramaic, and the second part is in Hebrew. Once we find the book of Esther, we have what we'll call Aramaisms, which are words, phrases, spellings, and syntax, which are more like Aramaic than they were Hebrew. We have the same thing in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and the book of Chronicles as well. So we find it grows and it seeps into the language. And more importantly, the script of Hebrew changes. The letters, the original Hebrew letters that were used, the ABC, were different before the exile than they are today. Today, we use Aramaic letters to write Hebrew. Not many people know that, but the Hebrew that you see have come from the Aramaic speakers. They are not the original Hebrew letters. If you want to see the original Hebrew letters, you need to find, I didn't bring one with me, I don't think, but if you find a shekel coin, you'll see the words Yehud, YHD, written in the original Hebrew script. So there's a big change, and Aramaic clearly did influence things. And they are sister languages, don't forget. They're not totally unrelated languages. If you can, for somebody who knows Hebrew, if you heard someone else speaking in Aramaic, you'd be able to get a fair amount of their discussion. And somebody who just can read Hebrew, if you see Aramaic, you look at it and you could struggle through, but you begin to understand the text that's actually been written. I told the story when we left Israel, we came back to England. My daughter, she must have been about 6 or 7 years old or something, and we were in England for about a year, and I pulled out Daniel chapter 3, which is written in Aramaic. And I said, Naomi, can you read any Hebrew? Can you still remember to read Hebrew? And she was struggling through this text and she couldn't read it. And I was starting to make fun of her, saying, you've forgotten your Hebrew. But it was Aramaic. And she still hasn't forgiven me for that, because she thought that she had lost it. She couldn't figure out why. It was kind of familiar. It looked the same, but she couldn't read it. She couldn't really read it that clearly. But it was Aramaic. They are nevertheless related languages. They're not that distant from each other. So we find in the Gospel, we find Jesus speaking Aramaic. He clearly knows Aramaic. He says, Talita Kumi, which means little girl, get up, which is very similar to Hebrew, but it's an Aramaic expression, an Aramaic phrase. We find also Eftaha, where he says, his eyes be opened when Jesus is healing. He's speaking Aramaic. These words are transliterated into Greek, but they are Aramaic words. This is what I meant. This is a sign that there is something going on underneath the Greek of the New Testament. There are Semitic tones, the Semitic flavors coming up underneath the Greek of the New Testament. So we find this word, it's written in Greek. It doesn't exist in Greek. We don't see this word in Greek anywhere in Greek literature, in any of the writings of the Greeks. But we see it, the transliteration here, because it is an Aramaic, and it makes much more sense in an Aramaic context. We hear Jesus saying, Lama sabachthani, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, when he is being crucified. Again, he is speaking here in Aramaic and not in Hebrew. The Hebrew psalm is different to me. It's Eli, Eli, Lama Azavtani, Lama Azavtani. That's what they say in Hebrew. That's what the psalm says. But here we have Jesus speaking in Aramaic. Jesus would clearly knew Aramaic. How many other people spoke it? You would assume many others, because it would have been still strong as an international language. We find in the days as well of the New Testament that there are many targumim. A targum is kind of like an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew scriptures. It served a little bit more than just a translation, because it was also an explanation too. And the theory behind it, now I don't know if this is true, but some scholars have suggested that the theory behind it was that in a synagogue, you would have somebody to read the Hebrew text, whatever it was, and next to them, there would be somebody reading a Targum translation for those who didn't understand Hebrew, who weren't that familiar with Hebrew. That's the theory behind it. How much of that is true, I'm not sure. But in any event, these translations pop up around the first century. A number of them pop up around the first century. Some obviously before the first century, but we have them. And so that shows that Aramaic was still alive and very much well during this period. And we also have in a place, a site around the north, I think, of the Dead Sea, a place called Wadi Murabaat, which is a small kind of like a wadi, is like a dry riverbed. And there are a number of texts there which were written in Aramaic, and they were just basically common texts, deeds, marriage certificates, marriage contracts, that sort of thing. You know, my donkey carried so much things to you, so many loads of this to you, or whatever. So we have a number of those texts as well, written in Aramaic. The fact that they were written in Aramaic strongly suggests that this was still used very much among the people. So Aramaic is alive and well. Greek, another language. 37% of the inscriptions found around Jerusalem were written in Greek. 37%. So that is to say, Greek must have also been used. It was also an international language, we know. So it was a popular language and it would have been used as well. Jesus would have probably grown up with a knowledge of the Greek language. He grew up in a multilingual society and conquest and a context. That's very important to understand, because many of us don't grow up in that, and many of us don't appreciate what it's like to be in that. If you grew up in places like Switzerland, you grow up on the borders around Germany, you're going to find that people grow and they speak French, German, and Italian very easily. And it's they just like their natural tongues, without any stuttering at all, because they grow up in that multilingual environment. And that's the type of environment I think Jesus would have grown up in. Acts 6 suggests there's a Hellenistic wing of the church. There is a text where there's a problem with the Greek widows and not being treated the same as the Hebrew widows, the first church strife that we see. So it's suggested that they would have been a large portion of Greek people in the church, probably Jewish, but definitely Greek speakers. We have new translations of the Bible in Greek, of the Old Testament in Greek. One of them, a version called Aquila, is written. It's the Old Testament, and it's in Greek written, possibly about this time, maybe a bit later. So it must have been used within Jewish circles and Hebrew circles as well. And then we have this inscription here, which I wanted to bring. This inscription was found in Jerusalem. No outsider shall enter the protective enclosure around the sanctuary, and whoever is caught will only have himself to blame for the ensuing death. This was apparently, there were a number of these around the inner area of the Jerusalem temple. And it was a warning to Gentiles, basically, going away from the court of the Gentiles, moving in to the sanctuary, to what would have been the court of the women. So anyone, you go that, you go to the temple, you go up onto the temple platform, you can walk around, but there was this place where you absolutely didn't go. And so that's what this inscription says. And what language is it written in? It's written in Greek. It's written in an international language. There was a very big, strong Greek Jewish community, we know, in Egypt during these days as well. So these guys come on pilgrimage. They had to be able to read and understand Greek. So Jesus would have been familiar with Greek. We can be very, very sure about that. Latin is a language, present but not common. Present but not common. Latin, did Jesus know Latin? Not sure. I've less conviction about that. He may have known some Latin words. This was a language that would have been more restricted to Roman soldiers speaking with each other. More restricted. Now, I'm not saying this, we're dealing with probabilities here, and I get that. So I'm not 100% sure. I wasn't there, I wasn't listening. But that is probably what we're dealing with. Mainly restricted to Roman soldiers. And we see that Aramaic, Latin, and Greek are the three languages that were written, because when you are crucified, you have to have what it is you have done above your head. And in this case, it was Pilate was saying he's king of the Jews. That was put above your head. The whole idea of crucifixion was a warning. So when you go into the city, you'd see and say, oh, this guy betrayed his master, and look at him. This guy stole from the treasury, and look at him. And so in three languages, in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek, we have the crime of Jesus' crime. And so it is written in Latin. So there must have been a degree of Latin around at the time. There would have been people from Rome traveling in and out of the city, and they would have seen this sign, and they would have been able to read it and able to be warned by it. So we have Latin less so. Now, the controversial aspect, the big controversial aspect, comes with Hebrew. How much Hebrew did Jesus know? This is a big deal. This is a big deal in recent scholarship. Many people believe that Jesus didn't know or speak Hebrew at all. And that is generally the underlying assumption of modern scholarship. And that's what you hear in many, many places, even symposia, in churches. Hebrew was not the language. The only Semitic language Jesus knew would have been Aramaic and not Hebrew. I would argue, and there is a large recent scholarship is beginning to roll on this one, that Hebrew would have been known and spoken by Jesus, that he would have known it. One reason, these are some of the reasons. One, we have the writings of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls don't say anything about Jesus, of course. But we have from the period of about 150 BC through till about 100 AD, we have a huge number of texts written in the Hebrew language. Not biblical texts, not just biblical texts being copied, but we're talking about the sect of the Dead Sea community were written in Hebrew. And it seems too much, it stretches my imagination too much to think that people were writing so many Hebrew texts, but nobody spoke it. That doesn't make any sense. It makes a lot of sense that during, and it certainly looks like this way, we mentioned the Hasmonean dynasty, we mentioned this resurgence of Jewish nationality, that the Hebrew language begins to come back and it makes a resurgence. And that's why we have so many of these new original texts being written in Aramaic. Okay, I have a Wi-Fi thing. Come on. Try that. So we have all of these writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls in Judea coming up, written in Hebrew, which suggests the Hebrew language was still living at this time. We have the Bar Kokhba letters. I mentioned to you about Bar Kokhba, this rebel who lived at the second and was the champion of the second revolt. He writes a number of letters to lots of different villages around in Hebrew. In Hebrew. It doesn't make sense that he is writing these letters in Hebrew and people aren't speaking Hebrew. They're only speaking Aramaic. So this attests to the fact that Hebrew was indeed a living language at the time of Jesus, not just Aramaic. We have as well this text in Acts 22, and when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew language, and that's what this says in Greek, Ebraidi dialecto, they became more quiet. So this is Paul speaking again in the Hebrew language, not Aramaic. This word in Greek never, never, never means Aramaic. It means Hebrew. So we've got this language context of Jesus it very much suggested that he would have known it because he grew up there. And then I was mentioning before this idea of Hebraisms, which we find in the gospel accounts, because the gospel was written in Greek. Yes, the Gospels were definitely written in Greek. There's a large school of thought in Israel that suggests that the Gospel of, I think, either Matthew or Luke was originally written in Hebrew, and we only have Greek copies. That's a theory. We don't have the Hebrew copies, so we don't know. So we've got to take a step back from that. What we do know is that the Greek is full of Hebraisms, expressions that do not work and are not found in Greek. So we've got basar v'dam, flesh and blood, to carry the meaning of being human. Flesh and blood hasn't revealed these things to you. That is an expression which we find elsewhere in Jewish literature, but we do not find in Greek literature. It's an expression that is very much Jewish to refer to man. The other one is the meaning of this word of righteousness, tzedekah. Tzedekah is, it means it's righteousness. If I say what is righteousness, you think in terms of righteousness as in apportioning goods to those who do good and evil to those who do evil, or good deeds. Specifically, only in Hebrew, the word righteousness, it takes on this context in the Mishnah as well, specifically means giving charity to the poor. Specifically means giving charity to the poor. If you find the Greek word for righteousness, it never has that meaning. Never ever has that meaning. But in the context of the Gospels, it does. What does that mean? It simply means that Jewish thinking was involved in the writing of the Gospel accounts. That's why it comes out. That's why we find these very peculiar phrases and words that don't make sense in Greek. And again, I'm not saying that the Greeks had nothing to do, or Hellenism had nothing to do with the writing, because I think it clearly does. We have in Paul's writings, we know some of them are structured according to Greek structures of writing letters and exhortations and songs. Some of the poetry Paul writes is in Greek, more kind of like a Greek meter than it is Israelite. So there is influence there. But my point is this, that Jesus would have known, and I believe taught as well in Hebrew, and we're going to see this again when we talk about his teaching methods, because the idea of parables that he told, parables are teachings that only work in Hebrew. We have no instances of Greek parables and no instances of Aramaic parables. Hebrew is the language in which they are taught in. It's wanting to connect to an internet. So just conclusions, short section. Some of the conclusions, one of them, Jesus knew Hebrew. He's there reading from a Torah scroll in a synagogue. That's what he's doing. He's not reading Greek. He's going to be reading Hebrew. He was raised in a multilingual society. He was raised in a multilingual society, where you're not just taught one language, even if it's not to read, to write the language, but he would have been listening to this all of the time. Which takes us on to sectarianism, which is the next topic that we're going to cover. Now, we have to cover all of the sects, so we will most likely have a break sometime in between, but diversity within Judaism. Let me begin by saying Judaism is not a monotheistic. It is a monotheistic, but it's not, what's the word I want? Monolithic. It's not monolithic. It's not, a Jew is not a Jew is not a Jew. And people very often have that thought. That's how they conceive it. But Judaism today is made up of many different branches. People, different Orthodox Jews follow different rabbis. You have Reformed Judaism, which is very secular and looser. You have Orthodox, you have the Haredim, you have the Hasidim, you have all of these different sects within Judaism. And the same goes as well, being as I'm there, goes for Messianic Judaism. A Messianic Jew is somebody who believes that Jesus is the Messiah, and there are many around today. But people often ask me, because I worked in a Messianic congregation, they say, well, you know, do the Messianic Jews believe this? But it's the same situation. Within the Messianic church, there are so many different factions. There are so many different groups and different areas that it would blow your mind. There are so many. There are groups that are on one hand that would believe that the Messianic Jews need to be more like regular Christians. So they need to ease up on all of the feasts and stuff like that. They need to adopt a lot more of the English commentaries and stuff like that in their teachings. More of the English songs. They would translate more of the English songs in their services. The other end of the scale, there are Messianic congregations that would say, no, we have to go back to Torah. So we have to read more Torah. We have to do more things in Hebrew. We have to generate or use Jewish songs, Orthodox Jewish songs, incorporate them into our worship, and set everything according to more according to a Jewish structure. And then you have many things which go in between. And so it's not a monolithic entity. There are all of these, and there are divisions, and I'll tell you even now, there are struggles going on. There are arguments going on amongst the Messianic congregation about how we should be doing things. No, you should not be doing this. Yes, this is what we should be doing. And it's, all of that is going on. It's not monolithic. Religions never are, in the same way as the Christian faith is not monolithic, and we don't, even though somebody would say they're a Calvinist, you know, do they believe in every point of Calvinism, all 5 points, or do they accept some other ideas, and how much a bit of this they think and a bit of that they think? Human beings are complicated. We shouldn't be settled with putting them in a particular box and saying that's what you are. This is how we have to see Judaism. We really must see Judaism in the first century period. I want to talk about, when we talk about sectarianism, I want to look at, we'll talk about each of the individual sects, and I want to talk about how Jesus actually relates with them. And ultimately, I want to ask this question, begin to get to the bottom of this question. Who is Jesus closest to, or is he independent from all of them? Is he doing something new, or is he closely aligned with any of these particular groups? So we're going to look at these. And we'll see how far we get. These are the groups, the major religious groups: Samaritans, Zealots, Sadducees, Essenes, and Pharisees. These are the ones which I will be looking at. And I'm sure you know these groups already. You've read about them in the Gospels. But I want to talk a little bit maybe about their beliefs, as much as I can about their origins, and then see how Jesus actually relates to them. Oh, sorry, I have to repeat. Samaritans, let's begin with them. And I've put here semi-Jews. What is a Samaritan? Very elusive, determining whom they are, what they represent. The name origins are, it's a bit tricky. It's more than a bit tricky, actually. Are they regional inhabitants, which is to say, there was a major area in the middle of Israel, I should have got a map, which is called Samaria. There was a city there as well, later called Sebaste, called Samaria, with a major city called Samaria. Does the name Samaritans come from this particular region? They're called Samaritans because they live in this particular area. That's one idea. Another idea is it comes from this word Shomronim, which means keepers. So do they see themselves as being keepers of the law, the true keepers of the law? And we're going to find out why in just a minute. So they're two different ideas, and it's always different because when you talk about a particular group of people, they always want to be associated with something noble and great and honorable. And so names kind of like develop that reflect that desire. So we have the Shomronim is, I think, is how they would really define themselves. But it's again, it's not. I'm not 100% sure on that. Are they Israelites? Well, yeah, no, kind of. They have very intertwined histories. They are connected, but they're disconnected. And so it's very, very, very difficult to narrow things down. If you look at the origins, the question of where they come from, you have to ask two different people. You have to ask one, you have to ask them, where do you guys come from? And you get one story. And then you have to ask an Israelite, where do the Samaritans come from? They'll give you a different story. And if you ask a historian, they'll give you a different story again. So you're going to have to, you know, take your pick as to where they're from. From the Samaritans, who are obviously still in existence today, they're still a group today. It's very sad because the Samaritan society today, they're very closed. And so there are a number of congenital diseases which are being propagated, and it's caused a lot of illness and sickness amongst them. So it's a very, it's in danger of dying out, you know, relatively soon. So anyway, in the Samaritan book of Joshua, and this book here, Kitab al-Ta'arikh, the writings of the ages or something like that, they have a story of their origins. And in that story, Eli, the priest, rebels. And he, at Gerizim, this is in Deuteronomy, when they're at Gerizim and Ebal, he rebels and he basically takes and he steals the Ark of the Covenant. And he runs away and establishes a fake priesthood in Shiloh. Shiloh is where we find the Ark was set up there in biblical literature for quite some time. But that's how that's what happened. And so what you are left with is that Israel is living in this rebellious stage underneath Eli, the rebellious priest. This is how the Samaritans would tell the story. And the Samaritans are the true people of God. And these are the ones that are really Hashomerim, keepers of the law, as opposed to this rebellious faction. So they would link their origins all the way back to that time with Moses, the end of Deuteronomy, all the way back to when Eli did this horrible thing. That's where they would connect themselves. And this is something common, many nations do this. They like to link themselves to something very noble and honorable and say that they are descendants of those things. The biblical picture of the, and again, this is a more of a Jewish picture, but the biblical idea of the origins is a bit different. They are, according to the biblical picture, a mixed population that originated from 722-721 BC. 722, this is the period in which, I don't know how much you know of Israelite history, but you basically had the kingdom of David set up, pretty much the first king of Israel. After David, we have Solomon, and he ruled over all of Israel. And then there was a breakup when Solomon died. And Solomon's son ruled over the southern kingdom called Judah, Rehoboam, and a popular general, Jeroboam, ruled over the north. And the northern kingdom, they were kind of separate, but the northern kingdom was destroyed in 722, Sennacherib III, I believe it was, and he exiled and took all of the Israelites in exile, and he scattered them, the 10 tribes. This is the whole idea of the 10 so-called lost tribes were taken at this time, about 721, 722 BCE. So that's hence that particular date, and instead of the 10 tribes, people brought in the Kuthians, I think it was, were brought in to populate that particular area. This is the account. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Kuta, Ava, Hamat, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. So now you've got a foreign group of people that are living in Israel at the time. But there's a problem. They didn't fear Yahweh, so the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. Then the king of Assyria issued a command, send back one of the priests who deported. Have him go and live there so we can teach them the requirements of the God of the land. So now we have this foreign people are still living in the northern kingdom in Israel, but there's a priest who's leading them in the service of God, what to do, how to make sacrifices, so on and so forth. So you've got a totally foreign people that are living as though they are Israelites, according to the laws of Israel. So you've got this kind of weird situation. Are they Jews? No, not really. But they kind of are, because they're kind of worshiping. They've got a Jewish priest, or they've got a Hebrew priest. So you've got that kind of weird situation, that strange dynamic. And these people were here from 722, so they would have lived there during the Babylonian exile as well. So in 587, when the Babylonians were taken, the Sumerians remain. They don't just remain, but they also think they can expand a bit, and they take control of the area, and then the Jews come back. So at that time, they are still there. These people weren't exiled. You don't have to read. This is big, a larger text. But this is basically a similar story from Josephus's point of view. Josephus, in Antiquities 9, in that you measure Josephus in paragraphs. I'll try and get you the texts here if I can, along with some other slides during the week. But he's basically saying the same thing, but listen to Josephus, who probably isn't too fond of them. When they, that's the Samaritans, when they see the Jews in prosperity, they pretend they are changed and allied to the Jews and call themselves kinsmen. As though they were derived from Joseph and had by that means an original alliance with them. But when they see them falling into a low condition, they say they are not related to them and that Jews have no right to expect any kindness or marks of kindred from them. So Josephus is here saying, you know, when the going's good with the Jews, then the Samaritans are Jews, we're all friends. But when it gets bad, they say, we've got nothing to do with them whatsoever. And this is a strange relationship between the two people. And even today, if you ask somebody, are the Samaritans Jews, people are going to be, kind of. I mean, they still keep the Jewish feasts. They still sacrifice. They still, you know, do all of these things in Shechem, in Israel. Are they Jews? Kind of, maybe. And that's, it's a very difficult situation to fully unpack. And this is picture of Shechem where it existed. And this for them is obviously a holy site. This is where Abraham first came. When he came into the land and he sacrificed and set up an altar here. You've got at the end of Deuteronomy, they've got the blessings and the curses on Mount Ebal and Gerizim. But this site here, Gerizim, is the site of their holy hill. This is the place that God has chosen to set his name for the Samaritans. And it would have been in this region, as I preached this a couple of weeks ago, that Jesus would have met the Samaritan woman. And she would have been saying, you guys believe it's in Jerusalem, but we believe it's here where you should be worshiping God. And Jesus said, yes, but there's coming a time when none of this is going to matter. And you're going to need to do something very, very different indeed. So we've got these two places, Gerizim and Shechem. We also have excavations on the top of Gerizim, this mountain here, which scholars or archaeologists believe they have found the excavations or the remains of a Samaritan temple up on Gerizim. A Samaritan temple. And this would have been destroyed during the days of Hyrcanus the First, one of the Hashmoneans. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But they believe it is. Now, this is one of the areas where I did some research on this. I looked it up. I found a bunch of articles saying, yes, definitely Samaritan temple. But I've read a couple of articles as well on this. And some people are saying, it might not be. So there's a degree of doubt about it, and you have to be very careful with archaeology generally, because archaeology is it's misleading, and if people, you know, if people want money and funds for archaeology, you have to say something important about the site you're working in, even though it's not true, and then everybody can pay you money, and then you can continue digging there. So I haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet, but these could be the remains of the Samaritan temple. Their beliefs and organization. What does a Samaritan believe? Believes in the five books of the Pentateuch, kind of. They believe in the five books of the Pentateuch, and this is a slightly different class which I teach on literature. Everything we're talking about now, most of what we're doing now, I've basically kind of condensed from a semester course on the history of Israel. So keep that in mind. But I do also teach some of this stuff on literature, Jewish literature, and the Samaritan Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible, but they have some small changes, little significant changes in there. And it's very clever the way in which they've done it. One of the things that they change concerns, it doesn't say that when the Lord your, you must worship God only at the place the Lord your God will choose, future tense, but it says you will worship in the place the Lord your God has chosen, past tense, Mount Gerizim in the book of Deuteronomy. So that's they make those sorts of changes that are specific to Samaritan religion, and which is why it is their own version. You will see as well they've done something very, very clever in their, this is obviously not that, this is obviously, you know, a codices, it's post first century, but the Samaritan Pentateuch is written in the ancient Hebrew script and not in the new corrupted Aramaic script that I told you about. So they keep it in the original script, and it's all a point of saying, yes, we are the original Hebrews, the people of God, and the rest are imposters. Gerizim obviously is the chosen site. That is the place that God had chosen to put his name. That is the place where the temple needs to be built and the ark needs to rest. So that's another one of their beliefs. They believe in the feasts. They still celebrate the regalim. The regalim are three feasts. The feast of Passover, the feast of Sukkot, 7 weeks after Passover, and the Sukkot, which is about now, right? We're about Sukkot now, and also Shavuot, 7 weeks after Passover. They're called the Regalim because all Israelite males were expected to make the journey and travel to Israel, to Jerusalem, to celebrate the feasts on those days. They reject Hanukkah and Purim, two Jewish, very Jewish feasts, not accepted by the Samaritans. The resurrection of the dead they currently believe in, but it is something that they have changed. Early Samaritan beliefs, the Second Temple period, they rejected the notion of the resurrection of the dead, but it is something that they have now adopted into their doctrinal statements. So we can see Samaritan-Jewish relationships, you can guess, based on animosity and tension between them at all times. One of the causes for contention would have been the return of the Jews. They controlled, the Samaritans controlled the region of Judah and that area. They had control of that, and then all of a sudden, through some ridiculous edict from the Persian king, they now have to share it with these people. And they're coming in, and they're doing their own thing, and that's causing a problem. So they had to change it. They lost a bit of administrative control as well, and that caused some of the problems that we see. They were excluded from Jerusalem temple, Ezra 4, 1 to 6. When Ezra comes back, he's building the temple, they say, hey, we want to come and join you too. We want to partake in worshiping the Lord. And Ezra says, no, no, no. And he kicks them out. He throws them away. And this causes a problem. This is further stress. This is further tension. And again, we're dealing with non-Jews, semi-Jews, people brought in from all over the place and have grown up there. They're now being told they can't partake. They're being excluded from religion. The Hashmoneans, I mentioned before, it looks like there's a record in Josephus of Hyrcanus I destroying the temple at Gerizim, which they talk about the remains being there represented. So they've got the Hashmoneans destroying the temple. That's another thing. It creates tension between Jews and Samaritans. And the development here of independent writings. We saw, I mentioned the Torah, but the other books as well. And this is what normally happens when there's any kind of enmity involved. And we see this in Judaism, Christianity as well. There are certain things you will find in the Talmud that specifically speak against Christianity. And so that's what you have. You find there are writings in the Samaritan books that speak against Jews and Judaism. And it happens all of the time. Naturally, this tension is reflected in the Gospels. These 12, Jesus sent out, instructing them, don't go in the way of the Gentiles and don't enter any city of the Samaritans, but rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Here in Matthew, it would therefore appear that Jesus doesn't see them as Jews. I think that's a fair statement. Don't go there. Just go to the lost sheep of Israel. That would be in the Galilee, past the Samaritans and down into Judea. He sent messengers. Jesus sent messengers ahead of him, and they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. But they did not receive him because he was traveling towards Jerusalem. And this is the place where I think it was it Thomas who wanted to call down fire from heaven and destroy the village. He says, Jesus, shall we just call down fire and destroy them, eliminate them? This is this reflects a degree of tension between them. Against that, though, there's also kind of a positive-ish image of the Samaritans in the Gospels. Jesus, and maybe it's mainly it's in the Gospel of John, who seems to see things very differently. Jesus shares the Gospel with a Samaritan woman in a Samaritan village. So on the one hand, he's telling them not to go out. Maybe the time wasn't right. But Jesus is there. He's stopping at this village, at this well, talking to this woman and sharing the Gospel with her. Samaritans are also used as good positive examples to shame Israelites. So the Good Samaritan, the parable of the Good Samaritan, these are, we get in the Gospels the same picture we get in history. The Samaritans are kind of Jews, but they're not Jews. They're kind of Jews, but they're not Jews. And they're treated this way, and it's difficult to see. They're not tight, but they're not that distant either. We find as well in the story of Luke of the grateful Samaritan, which, 10 people get healed, one person returns and they're a Samaritan. He got healed as well. So, is he Jewish? Is he not? It's difficult to identify categorically. And so I raised this question here. Is Jesus a Samaritan? Now, okay, I hear you. You can laugh at that. Why would I ask that question? It's a very interesting text, which was, you read the Bible so much, but you don't read it. It doesn't sink in until somebody else tells you something. But watch this text, okay? Jesus answered, they said to him, the Jews answered and said to Jesus, do we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan and you have a demon? And Jesus says, I don't have a demon. Am I right in saying you're a Samaritan, you don't have a demon? Jesus says, I don't have a demon. What about a Samaritan part of that statement? It's weird. It's really, really weird. And was he? He's probably not a Samaritan. Okay, we know that. Jesus wasn't a Samaritan. But it's clear that in his answer, at least, Jesus is aligning himself with them. Either Jesus is, or John is obviously doing something here, because we know that John, because it's in John that we find Jesus sitting next to the Samaritan woman in the by the well. John, obviously, I don't know if John has kind of is viewing the church and his believing community. Don't forget, John wrote way after these events. But in John's believing community, I don't know if they were being ostracized in the same way Samaritans were ostracized by Jews in his day. And so is he trying to make Jesus look like somebody who goes out to the ostracized people, who cares for the ostracized people? And I don't know if he's doing this, but I do know that it is really peculiar to put this answer here and to phrase it in this particular way. So with that said, Jesus is probably not a Samaritan. Okay, I don't think so. That was provocative and okay. So let's look at the zealots. We'll look at the zealots and then we'll pause. That'll take us to the top of an hour. We'll pause for a bit before continuing. So we've got the zealots. Armed resistant movements. Josephus calls these people the fourth philosophy. You're going to see a number of texts from Josephus and that talk about the different sects and the different groups. And he names three of them, but he simply refers to zealots as the fourth philosophy. The zealots. Generally, it's a title applied to those acting with zeal. This is not like there was no kind of like a zealot badge or anything like that. There were lots of different groups around. And here, this is, I think, the root of the name comes from this action here. If you remember in the book of Numbers, Phinehas picks up a spear after the Moabites trick the Israelites into getting involved in all kinds of really strange religious services. He picks up, Phinehas sees an act, they're performing some kind of worship act right in the tabernacle, and Phinehas picks up a spear and he kills them both with it, with the spear. He impales both of them into the ground. And this is an act of zeal, and Phinehas is rewarded for this act, and God makes a covenant of peace with him. And in doing so, he stayed a plague that comes across the people as well. So this is an act of zeal, which is caused by seeing unrighteousness and just having to act upon it. And this is the kind of mentality that the zealots adopted. The unrighteousness of the Romans, these heathens in our land, taking up our space, telling us what we are, what we should and shouldn't be doing. There's an individual called Judas the Galilean who is a figurehead. He lived in Galilee. We'll talk about Galilee a bit later on. But he was one of the main figureheads for this movement. And we have a text about him, right? Josephus mentions him. Now, Archelaus was part of Judea, was reduced into a province, and Coponius, one of the equestrian orders among the Romans, was sent as procurator, having power and life in Caesar. Let's get down to the interesting bit. Under his administration, it was that a certain Galilean, whose name was Judas, prevailed with his countrymen to revolt and said that they were cowards if they would endure to pay a tax to the Romans and would, after God, submit to mortal men as their lords. This man was a teacher of a peculiar sect of his own and was not at all like the rest of their leaders. Josephus hated zealots. He absolutely hated them. So he has absolutely nothing good to say to them about them at all. But this man we know would have lived before, just before the days of Jesus, and Jesus would have known about him. That's without a doubt. The Zealot movement originates in Galilee. This will become late important, very important to note later on. So we've got Judas. Even before Judas, there was another man, Hezekiah, who was also seen as being a rebel. But we'll, you know, get to talk about him when we speak about Herod a bit later. So we've got this movement originating in Galilee, gaining strength in Galilee. And we find in the first result, many of the zealots are up in, and they're fortifying the Galilee area. And after that's destroyed, then they all come down to Jerusalem. Their beliefs. This here is a picture of something called the knife. It's a Sichari knife. And the Sichari were a particular sect of zealots. And they used to go into crowds and they used to attack anybody, Romans and those who are associated with them. And they would walk into crowds, pull out the knife, kill them, and just walk off with somebody falling down dead. So they were a branch of the zealots. No special religious beliefs. So they weren't like, they never had a religious book or anything like that as the Samaritans had. They were advocates of resistance to Roman rule. So they were the people that were probably most affected or had the memory of the Hashmoneans in their minds, thinking we can overthrow them. We hate the Romans. They shouldn't actually be here. So they hated Roman rule, and they hated those who supported or those who were seen siding with Roman rule. They absolutely hated. For the zealots, taxes equal slavery. Payment of taxes equal slavery. This is the key issue when they come to Jesus saying, shall we pay the tax? This is what's going on. They are saying, are you a zealot? Are you related to the zealots? Because if you pay taxes, then you are a slave and you are on their side. And that's what that conversation is all about. So they refused to pay taxes. They totally disdained it, and that's how the zealots identified themselves. They believed that the nation was free under God. They should have no master, no servant other than God. That's what they believed, and they were obviously willing to fight to defend that. Violence was an option. Violence was an option. And so you can see again this idea of Phineas all those years back is still influencing their thinking, because if you do a violent act to uphold the will of God, you have done a good thing and God is going to be proud of you. And we see this obviously type of thinking today in Hamas, those Palestinian movements, which violence to uphold the will of God is a good thing. It's same with obviously the Crusaders. You know, Christians, we're marred with, our history is marred with this idea of violence as being an option if it's for the will of God, or you believe it's for the will of God. That same thinking we need to apply down to the zealots as well. Jesus and the zealots, where do the zealots come in Jesus' thinking and in the New Testament? We finish with this slide, we'll take a break. A disciple of Jesus, we have Simon the Zealot, whom he actually recruits. Jesus recruits somebody who's called a zealot. That's how you identify individuals in those days. His name was Shimon, but there would have been 50 people called Shimon. How do you identify people from the villages that they come from? Such as Judas comes from a village called Kariot. Ish, it means man. So we say Judas is an Ish, a man from Kariot. That's how you identify, because everybody was called Judas. It was such a popular name. Simon was this one particular one called, seems to have been, have connections with the zealots. which is wild in and of itself. Simon versus Matthew, I put this here because we know that Matthew was a tax collector. He was somebody that was sided with the Romans. And now we have Jesus who is going out of his way to recruit two opposite ends of the spectrum. Someone who hates the Romans and the taxes, and someone who is collecting it. And he comes and he brings these people in together to be disciples. And it, you know, Jesus must have been a referee. With all of those people in there, dealing with the hot-tempered, the quiet, the proud, the humble, all of these people in there together, he has to deal, he has to manage these characters for 3 years before his death on the cross. But that we read lightly, but it would have been a big deal. It would have taken up a lot of energy to deal with. Was Jesus doing this to increase religious diversity amongst his followers? These were the 12 disciples, which equate to the 12 tribes of Israel, who were going to judge all the peoples one day. Was Jesus doing this deliberately to create religious diversity, to know that when he dies, his message and his movement can go out to all? No sect of society can turn around and say, well, that's not for us. Because if the zealot says not for us, we say, what about Simon? You know, the tax head says it's not of us. Well, what about Matthew? He could do this. The hot-headed can say it's not for us. You know, what about Peter? So you've got all of these examples within the 12 disciples. And it looks, I mean, if I were going to form a movement, that's a really smart thing to do. Bring in everybody. Don't just bring in people who think and do things like you. Bring in everybody so everybody can be reached. And that certainly seems to be what Jesus is doing here. Jesus, I believe, was considered to be, in some circles, a zealot. I believe he was, people were aligning him, not him. Others were seeing him in that particular light. Jesus was from the Galilee. He's from the Galilee. That's where the movement began. The Galilee is detached from the main police force in Judah. That's where all the strongholds were, the mountainous territory was. He's from that area. People thought, well, he could be a troublemaker. Certainly the Romans would have looked at him in this way. When Jesus is arrested in Matthew 26:47, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now that's troubling in and of itself as to why priests need thugs. But the fact that you're sending out a gang of thugs for Jesus suggests in your mind, this guy is from the Galilee, this guy is probably related to the zealots, we've got to take no chances. If there's going to be an uprising, we've got to be able to quell it. Now, was Jesus a zealot? No. He had no problem with paying taxes. He knows that he has to do it, so that's not an issue. But it certainly looks as though the people from the south, the temple parties, would have considered, or may well have considered, that Jesus was one of them. I'm going to pause there. We can take a break. And then we can start thinking and talking a little bit about the Sadducees, which is another group. Ooh.